recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Let's give her a hand for that. Thanks. Over and above that, Betty does an amazing job every day. She's been at this in the School of Education here at Whitworth for the past 13 years. Prior to that, she was a faculty member at Gonzaga University. She got promoted, came to Whitworth. I know there's Gonzaga people out here. I know that. So, and Randy's a good friend of mine. So, Betty has her PhD from University of Kansas in Child and Developmental Psychology. At Whitworth, in addition to her leadership in special education, she is an outstanding professor in that discipline as well, an amazing colleague and author. Those of us who know Betty really don't know how she gets it all done. We really suspect there's a twin somewhere that does a lot of the work when she's doing other things. She's just an amazing faculty member. So I know you're anxious to hear this presentation, so I'll step out of the way and ask Dr. Betty Williams to begin her presentation tonight. Thank you, Betty.
Thank you, Dennis. I think that's really wise to get applause before you start. And I should ask, this is a little different presentation tonight, but let me see who's out here in the audience. How many of you are family members with a family who has someone on the autism spectrum? Okay. And how many of you are professionals who work with people on the autism spectrum? And I need to ask, how many of you are behaviorists? Or future behaviorists. Okay. That's where tonight's presentation is a little bit different. I do have to acknowledge Edward B. Lindemann, who was a president here at Whitworth University, and he tragically died too soon and was taken from the midst of his job. But he left a legacy that supports faculty research and gave me enough time and release from coursework to do the study on autism for the last 4 years. And some of you have been with me for 4 years. I think that must be a little bit like watching the president in his last term in office. And what you really remember most are how many more gray hairs and wrinkles he's accumulated over that time. That may be what's happened here. But it is in his memory that I've been able to do this research. An important product of the last 4 years was a book that I co-authored with my husband, Dr. Randy Lee Williams. And many of you have been to the previous lectures, and those lectures all went into that textbook. So there's a good share of that book that talks about things we've covered earlier, including the characteristics of autism, also talked about the research on the causes of autism, and on a variety of treatments for autism, which ones have been proven effective and which ones have not yet been proven effective that we're still questioning. But I wanted to talk tonight about the second half of that book, and it is a little more specialized because of our work using applied behavior analysis. I want to cover are some of the history of the behavioral movement, some of the principles that are developed that we use in our work. And then I want to share with you some of the most effective research centers around the United States. As part of our research, my husband and I had the wonderful opportunity of traveling throughout the United States and also to Great Britain to visit a variety of centers that had exceptionally strong research-based effectiveness. And when we visited those centers, they were absolutely transparent to us. They let us spend hours talking to their staff and interviewing people. They let us observe their clients that they were working with. They answered our questions about how they had developed their programs and how they supervised their staff and how they trained their staff. And the one thing that we learned as we went from one center to another, however, was that some of the people in those centers actually didn't know very much about other centers that were around the United States. Or what they did know was outdated. They had these old images of what people were doing. And we would walk out of one after another fabulous place and just say, wow, they just don't understand. That's not your father's Oldsmobile. Well, that's how I came up with that title. Now, some of you are too young to remember this, so let me explain this phrase a little bit. The Oldsmobile Motor Company was actually founded in 1897 in Lansing, Michigan, which is only about 30 miles from where I grew up. And a great many of the people I knew worked in the motor industry. Motown was not that far away, an hour's drive. But by the late 1970s and early 1980s, the Oldsmobile actually was the best-selling car in America. And here's a nice prime 1971 Oldsmobile 442. Wouldn't you like to own that today? But by the late 1980s, their sales had started to fall. And so they generated this public commercial campaign that was supposed to gather interest from a younger generation of drivers. And so they coined the phrase, "Not your father's Oldsmobile." And unfortunately, this actually hurt sales because actually their parents literally owned Oldsmobiles. And this was the 70s, and they wanted to rebel and go against tradition. And so it didn't work. It happened to fail. But that's why we use the term, not your father's Oldsmobile. This kind of stuck with us. I know. There we are in 1971 or thereabouts. We were a bit younger then, a little flashier too. Okay. But we were actually at that time graduate students, and we were elbows deep in working with children with autism. Really, at about the time that the whole field of special education was being invented, and we literally did invent a few things that we take credit for today, like the use of sign language with children who are nonverbal, even if they could hear, and so on. Now, we worked with wonderful faculty and wonderful students who actually went out and have made amazing improvements in special education around the world. But we all based our instructional techniques on the work of B.F. Skinner. He was the American behaviorist. He was an author, an inventor, and a social philosopher. He was professor of psychology at Harvard University from 1958 until his retirement in 1974. But he spent another 20 years into his 90s lecturing and writing. He was the author of 21 books. And was considered the most influential psychologist of the 20th century. Through Skinner's experimental research with animals, he identified some very basic behavioral principles and wrote extensively about their application to people. Now, lest you think that animals don't have much to tell us about how people behave or about people learn, I want to show you a brief clip from some of Skinner's earlier work. And we'll make sure I can make this happen.
Can pigeons read? This one gives every indication, because he's been taught to distinguish between two words and to behave appropriately. He's learned his different response to each sign by being rewarded with food. So the bird isn't acting independently. Its behavior is shaped by controlling its environment. The first task was to isolate an individual piece of behavior and see how that could be changed. Skinner did this by keeping individual pigeons at about 3/4 of their normal weight, so that the birds were always hungry, and food could be used as an automatic reward.
We were so inspired that we taught our dog to read. And he actually did. He could read bark and jump, and that worked beautifully for a while. And then we moved and lost his reading cards and had a baby and never got back to it. We started teaching babies how to read then. But Skinner and the behaviorists that followed him look at human behavior in terms of a three-term contingency. It's sometimes called an ABC analysis. They look at the antecedent, what comes before a behavior, a stimulus that comes before a behavior, which they refer to as a response. And they look at the consequence that comes after a behavior, another stimulus after a behavior. And then they watch to see how it influences that behavior. If the behavior is going to increase or decrease, will it occur again or will it cease? And both the antecedent and the consequence influence the likelihood of that response occurring again. So they're both very important. Whoa. Let's go back. These are just a few of the principles of learning that Skinner identified first with animals and that we later replicated with people. Consequences that increase or decrease a behavior are called by different terms depending on their effects. So reinforcement is somewhat easy to remember because reinforcement causes a behavior to repeat more often. Positive reinforcement just means that the consequence adds something to the situation and the behavior repeated more often. For example, if you go to make a telephone call and you push the buttons on your phone, and if that sequence is correct, your friend answers the telephone, and you're more likely to push those buttons on that phone in that same sequence again. You've been reinforced. Negative reinforcement just means that the consequence involves taking something away from the situation. For example, if you have a migraine headache, but your doctor's given you some prescription medicine and you take it and the pain goes away, you're more likely to use that prescription medicine in the future. You've been reinforced this time because something's been removed or taken away. Now, since we know that a behavior occurs because something's reinforcing it, we could decrease that behavior if we withhold that reinforcer. We call that extinction. Again, easy to remember because think of the dinosaurs that are extinct. I'm going to come back and talk about differential reinforcement in a minute. Punishment is a consequence that decreases behavior, either some kind of consequence that's been presented or taken away. Most people think of punishment as something very aversive, and it might be, but sometimes something very mild also decreases our behavior. When I grew up, I learned to call everybody sir and ma'am, and I discovered first in high school and then in college that people thought I was being sarcastic. So I would say, yes, sir. And they'd say, don't call me sir anymore. And I'd say, okay, I'm not going to call you sir anymore. And it punished my behavior, but it wasn't really a very aversive thing. However, because there are often aversives used and there are a lot of side effects with punishment, most behaviorists discourage the use of punishment. We won't talk too much about that tonight. So a reinforcer, this is a basic term. To determine if a behavior has been reinforced, we have to know if it increased following that consequence. And you need to keep in mind that even a consequence that seems very rewarding might not actually increase a particular individual's behavior. And vice versa, sometimes something that doesn't seem that rewarding or great to you may actually be very reinforcing to someone else. For example, I know quite a number of children with autism will work very hard if they get the opportunity to run a vacuum cleaner. There's something about the sound of that vacuum cleaner. It's very reinforcing, and you can increase their behavior. But I need to tell you right now, if I worked very hard and you gave me the opportunity to run a vacuum cleaner, it probably would not reinforce my working very hard. Probably not going to happen. So let me give you an example of positive reinforcement. Suppose that you ride this subway train to work, and when you get off the train, you have your choice of taking the escalator up to street level or walking those stairs. You're probably more likely to take the escalator. But we know that exercise would be healthier for us overall, and so Volkswagen undertook a public project to see if they could increase the use of the stairs, see if they could reinforce each individual and get them to use the stairs more often. So let's see what happened. It's in Swedish, but the translation is the fun theory. Thank you. increase in the use of the stairs. And if that were an individual who increased his use of the stairs by 60%, then we'd say, wow, we had reinforcement. And look how much fun they had. I love the fun theory. Now, we know that if a behavior is occurring, something's reinforcing it. And if it's a problematic behavior that we'd like to get rid of, then what we have to do is withhold the reinforcer. But unfortunately, people don't like it when you withhold their reinforcers. And we tend to get what's called an extinction burst. So when we put a person on extinction, they tend to, at first, actually respond at a little bit higher rate and with a lot more intensity before it gradually decreases and fades away. So think about a pop machine that you go to, you put your money in and you get pop out and you're pretty happy. But the day you go and put money in and nothing comes out, you are not very happy. So you put your money in a couple more times and then you shake the machine a little. Maybe you kick the machine, maybe say some things you shouldn't say before you walk away. Tomorrow you're probably less likely to put your money in, but you get a little bit of burst before that occurs. So we say extinction is tough. And here's a situation most parents could relate to. You're on the telephone, and your child starts to cry. And being a good parent, you pick up your child and comfort your child. But pretty soon you realize that whenever you answer the telephone, your child starts to cry or tantrum. And you decide, wait a minute, I've just taught the child to cry when I'm on the phone, so I am not going to pick up this child. And what you find is that first there's an increase in the tantrums and then they decrease a bit. But you have to be prepared for that burst if you're going to use extinction. So I'm going to show you a little video. Imagine that the phone was a mobile phone. And this is what you might see happening. Oh, back. I apologize for the name of this site, but I didn't name it. Parent or not, you can relate to that. You understand what's happening there. Now, eventually, the child will learn to stop tantruming when you're on the phone, but it will take a while, and you have to be prepared for that. So one of the procedures that we use a lot is differential reinforcement, which actually seems to help modify that extreme extinction burst that might occur. And all we mean by that is if I have an inappropriate behavior I want to put on extinction, I will make a reinforcer available for a replacement behavior. So, yes, I'm not getting reinforced for this behavior, but I can get a reinforcer for doing something more appropriate, and therefore we can replace it. So, for example, a child wants something in the store, and the child goes, give me that, give me that. And so what do you say? Please. Okay, then you get it. So demanding something gets extinguished, but asking nicely gets reinforced, and in the long run, we'll see the child asking nicely more often. Again, let me give you another example of differential. Well, let's diagram that first. We'll show you the antecedent. Let's say you're at the table. You have a child who has autism and doesn't speak, but you're trying to teach an appropriate communication. If the child points, you'll give the child whatever that is at the table that the child wants. But if the child cries, you're going to withhold it. You just have two things happening at once in differential reinforcement. I know, some of you have seen this in class already.
Are you finished?
Well, thank you. How thoughtful. Would you like a chocolate?
Yeah, sure. Sorry, Sheldon, I almost sat in your spot.
Did you? I didn't notice. Have a chocolate.
Thank you.
You're here a lot now.
Oh, am I talking too much? Oh, I'm sorry. Zip.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Chocolate?
Yes, please. You know what? Hold on. Let me take this in the hall. You'll never guess who they got to a place with.
Okay. I know what you're doing.
Really?
Yes. You're using chocolates as positive reinforcement for what you consider correct behavior.
Very good. Chocolate.
Sheldon, you can't train my girlfriend like a lab rat.
Actually, it turns out I can.
Well, you shouldn't.
There's just no pleasing you, is there, Leonard?
You weren't happy with my previous approach to dealing with her, so I decided to employ operant conditioning techniques, building on the works of Thorndike and B.F. Skinner. Yet by this time next week, I believe I can have her jumping out of a pool, balancing a beach ball on her nose. No, this has to stop now.
I'm not suggesting we really make her jump out of a pool. I thought the bazinga was implied. I'm just tweaking her personality. You're sanding off the rough edges, if you will.
No, you're not sanding Penny.
Are you saying that I am forbidden from applying a harmless, scientifically valid protocol that will make our lives better?
Yes. You're forbidden.
Bad, Leonard.
And that was punishment, and that's why we don't recommend punishment. It's one of our last resorts when it's absolutely necessary for other reasons. Okay. And actually, Sheldon and his roommate summarized a lot of the arguments for and against behavioral approaches. To some people, it does seem contrived. It does seem manipulative because you're controlling someone else's behavior. To behaviorists, we would respond in much the same way. But isn't that a scientifically valid way to improve a behavior, to polish those rough edges, to make that person more acceptable? Skinner himself actually did not experiment with people. He kept his experimentation in the lab with animals. There were other behaviorists who did the experimentation to try out these behavioral principles to see if they really worked with people the way Skinner had theorized in his many books that they would work. A very important place early in the 60s for our work was actually the University of Washington. A behaviorist named Sid Bijou, who had worked at Indiana University with Skinner, gathered a remarkable group of graduate students and faculty at the University of Washington at the Institute for Child Development. The Institute was full of energy. It was a productive place where young children with very severe disabilities and developmental delays, including autism, were being treated behaviorally and resulting in significant and remarkably optimistic outcomes. This was the beginning of applied behavior analysis. The first research published on the use of applied behavior analysis with children with autism came out of the University of Washington in 1964. And actually, Todd Risley, Don Baer, and Mont Wolf, I didn't have a photo of, actually coined the term applied behavior analysis in an article they published in a journal they established in 1968. And that's really what we're here talking about tonight, how these behavioral principles work in real life settings with real people who have great needs. Also among those remarkable students at the University of Washington was a young man named Ivar Lovaas. Ivar Lovaas was actually a recent immigrant to the United States. he'd discovered that he could get a scholarship to play the violin, and he came over to our country and then studied psychology and ended up as a graduate student at the University of Washington. He was fascinated with the idea of how language developed, and so he began working with children with autism because they had language delays. And his idea was, great, here's a human who has no language, and I can learn from teaching this child how language develops. I have a blank slate to work with. And he quickly forged a lifetime dedicated to helping children with autism recover from autism. He eventually moved his work to California's Camarillo State Hospital. And the Lovas initially intended to teach nonverbal children how to speak. He discovered that there were a lot of other problems that got in the way of teaching them to speak. Some of them were self-injury. They were self-stimulating. They perseverated on repetitive tasks. Lots of things that were very disruptive to learning. So initially, Lovas and his students couldn't go ahead with teaching them how to speak until they learned how to control those behaviors. He worked very carefully and very systematically, applying reinforcers for appropriate responses. And at this point, he was using punishers for incorrect responses and inappropriate behaviors. His therapist expressed very strong emotions because they didn't think the children with autism could understand the differences when they should be happy, when they were getting the reinforcer, and when they should understand that they were being punished. So they used very strong emotions when they worked with the kids. He taught them in very small steps that he called discrete trial training, working one-on-one with a child. Therapists went through each one of these steps. He would give a cue. He'd say, "What's this?" And then the therapist would prompt the child, say, "Glass." And if the child said, "Glass," then he would get a reinforcer. In his very early stages, he was giving mostly edibles and with a very enthusiastic, "Good job!" And if the child had answered incorrectly, would have been told no or something more aversive. Then he would wait while the child ate his treat. Then they'd start the next trial, one after another after another. I want to show you some early footage in the 60s with a therapist using this Lovas approach. And I will let it speak for itself. It actually is titled The Bad Old Ways, now that we look back at this video. And you'll see why pretty quickly.
Good looking. Touch black. That's right. Good boy. Good boy. Good. Good looking.
Rotate stimuli.
Right. That's good work. Good boy. Touch white.
Introduce new tasks after old ones are mastered.
Now look at me. Good looking. Hands quiet. Good. Look at me. Good boy. Touch white.
White.
No. Touch white.
White.
No. Hands quiet. Look at me. Valentine, look at me. Good looking. That's good boy. Touch white. Good touching, that's right. Good boy. Good boy.
Okay. So you can see that looks pretty contrived. Looks very unnatural to have a young child sitting so stiffly and having someone say the same words over and over again in that way. And also using the aversive of no. If really inappropriate behavior occurred, they might even slap a child or do something very aversive. And that combination of harsh aversives, slaps, and sometimes shouted reprimands, along with a heavy schedule of primary and social reinforcers, kind of became what Lovas's ABA therapy was known as. As I say, a lot of people still thought it was the same way. Even these research-based, highly effective places that we visited in the last few years, we're still saying, well, we don't use LOVAS because we don't use aversives. We don't believe in any of that. Like, well, okay. But they got some of that because of an article that came out in Life magazine. It was published under the title Screams, Slaps, and Love in 1965. And it described LOVAS's work at the University of California, Los Angeles, declaring a surprising, shocking treatment helps far-gone mental cripples. It sensationalized the severe and dangerous behaviors of children who were being studied and detailed the calculated harshness of LOVAS's extraordinary new treatment. It also did go on to emphasize the patience and tenderness, the rewards of food and affection and approval that were used. But the photographs were like this. This is one of the photographs from the article. And in the public's mind, that photograph remained. And so many people reject ABA because they think of it as LOVAS's ABA from the 60s, which was very rigid and very harsh. Oh, even that early work, however, with those children who were institutionalized proved really helpful for the children. But they learned a lot of lessons about how therapy really should be done with children. And they changed their approach to therapy and also made it more successful. These were some of the lessons that they learned. They learned they needed to begin with children as young as possible in order to be successful. When they had first started, they were working with children who were institutionalized. So their families had raised them to a point when they were finally diagnosed with a severe condition of autism and went through the process of giving them up and putting them in institutions. So they were 8, 9, 10 years old. And they found they needed to work with children, preschoolers, if possible, as young as possible, as young as they could be diagnosed. They still used discrete trial training because they found that they needed to sequence a multitude of skills, core skills that these children needed to have. But they changed that treatment as well. They found it much better to work in the home because the home is where you have to use the skills that you learn. And a child could transfer, generalize those skills to the settings where he played and lived or to their early school settings. They found they needed to use parents as a primary therapist. Parents would live with these children the rest of their lives. They're the ones who need to do most of the work. But there was a lot of work to be done. And so they encouraged parents to hire additional people who could work as therapists. Because what they found was that for best outcomes for these very young preschoolers, they needed to work 40 hours a week, one-on-one, going through each one of these skill areas. They also found it was important, though, to provide interaction with normal children. So sometimes the therapist would move on with the child to preschool or kindergarten settings and help them working with other with normal children. And they found that edibles weren't the best reinforcers in the world. They needed to use things from a child's natural environment, the toys that a child would play with, or those things that stimulated a child, like a music box or something from the home, and that those were great reinforcers for a child. And they modified their training to provide breaks. So we do a task or several tasks, take a small break, and every hour take 15 minutes to play and to move, like normal children do, to be more developmentally appropriate. So this is more like what today's ABA therapy would look like. They're still sitting at a table, but we saw a lot of therapy where the kids worked on the floor, like normal children play on the floor.
Nathan! Crutchfielding! Good boy!
Oh, he gets to play with the toys that he likes. He can choose.
It's bubbles out he did. Not chewy. Smells yummy, these bubbles. Smells like strawberries. Station train, drive around, you can still see it. Looking at
A little more like the fun theory in action. And when Lovaas released his data from their first, their largest study in 1987, they documented substantial, durable best outcomes for children who received their intensive 40 hours a week one-on-one ABA therapy if they started prior to the age of four. In fact, their outcomes were that almost half of their children were fully recovered. We don't say cured because we're not sure what causes autism, but we say recovered, meaning that they looked like their age mates. They looked like normal children. You could not identify who had had a history of autism and who had not. Half of their children had those best outcomes. The other half of the children did not have those best outcomes. They still required special education, but they had acquired a lot of skills, and they continued to learn. It's just that they would always need intensive instruction across the years. But to have almost half be fully recovered was incredible. And to this day, we have no other treatment that can report such results. A lot of people were skeptical, and there were many critics who said, that's a fluke, you faked your data, and so on. And so replications were made. In the 1990s, there were replications made in multiple sites around the United States and also around the world. So there were sites. We visited one of the replication sites in England. We spoke with the director of one of the replication sites from Norway. They had replication sites all over the world, and they were reporting almost exactly the same percentages of recovery. So implementing in a whole variety of settings, it still was highly effective. In fact, Dr. Frank Gresham, who was a colleague of Lovaas's at UCLA, was a well-known and respected critic of Lovaas's ABA therapy. And the government of Canada was considering whether their socialized medicine should pay for ABA treatment for children with autism. And so they asked, actually was reviewed in their higher courts, they asked Frank Gresham to be there as a professional reviewer. And he went through the replication data in all of the updated studies, and he actually declared in the official court papers, there is no question that ABA is the treatment of choice for children presenting with autistic disorder. And at this point in time, if you make any review of the credible websites that are out there by organizations made up of families and professionals working with children with autism, you will see repeatedly the recommendation that ABA therapy be started as early as possible. Now, what happened is it became so acceptable that when you talk to people in general and you say, I have applied behavior analysis therapy for your behavioral treatment, they assume you mean Lovaas. It's come to mean the same thing. They think Lovaas invented ABA. They don't know anything about B.F. Skinner and his work with animals and all the other people that were involved. Lovaas invented ABA, and that's the only brand there is. And very often, again, they recall those early images of its first stages when it was a pretty rigid and sometimes aversive therapy, and they say, I'm not going to do ABA with my kids because that's the image that they have in their minds. What I would like to do is introduce you to a few of the centers that we visited and talk to you about some of the extensions and some of the variations in ABA therapy, some of the things that look different from Lovaas's therapy. The first recent approach I want to talk to you about was developed by Dr. Robert Cagle. And Robert Cagle was a student of Ivar Lovaas's, a graduate student under Lovaas at UCLA. But he wanted to develop a more naturalistic treatment, a natural therapy. He wanted to, so he moved to the University of California, Santa Barbara, and actually later married one of his former students, Lynn Cagle, and they've become partners in this research and have developed what's now called pivotal response training. Let me get back again. his thinking started with what's called the natural language paradigm. He wanted to motivate communication, but he wanted to do it in a natural setting, and he wanted to use the kinds of reinforcers that children would naturally choose for themselves. He wanted to set things up so that they weren't so contrived, so they looked like the real world. And what he would do is he might have a child with autism in the room, and he would set up for that child an array of toys, but they would be toys that required an adult to help the child. So it might be a wind-up top that would spin, or a wind-up music box that would play a song, or a train that, if when it was moved, would make train sounds and so on, if you push the buttons right and did so. The child couldn't really make those things happen by himself if he was too young and didn't understand how to do it. But if he made any communication gesture, then Kegel would quickly get the toy started and play with him. So he tried to set it up so that we took advantage of the natural situations. And he decided that in doing so, he had identified one of the first pivotal responses, and that's motivation. If you had something that was naturally motivating for a child, he would learn tasks faster, he would be able to respond more quickly, he would show improved affect, like smiling, he'd be enjoying what he was doing. He defines a pivotal response as central to wide areas of functioning and improvements that would occur across a large number of behaviors. So whereas Lovaas was sitting down doing discrete trial training on each tiny skill for hours on end, what Kegel wanted to do was, let's find those pivotal behaviors. If I find I can motivate a child, I could use that motivation across all these other behaviors. I wouldn't have to teach every single little skill. I start to teach a wide variety of skills. And one of the things that they accepted, too, was you didn't have to just answer correctly to get your reinforcer. If you just tried, if you made the attempt, we would reinforce you. Anything that was starting to motivate you in that direction. And we could mix easier with harder tasks to make the learning more fun. He uses what's called functional assessment. He says, you know, if you have problem behaviors, and we know that our children with autism often develop problem behaviors, very often because they can't communicate, let's find out what the reinforcers are for those, and then get a replacement behavior, a little differential reinforcement in action. Sorry, I'm losing my microphone here. It uses the ABC analysis that we talked about in the first place. He found that it was best to work in the natural environment, so he learned the same lesson Lovaas did. If you want the child to talk at home, let's do the teaching at home. If you want the child to interact in the preschool, let's do the teaching in the preschool. And he involved parents, that parents would have some skills to work with their children on their own. And a lot of the reason for doing that was to reduce stress. I think as a couple and parents themselves, they were very conscious of what families went through when they had children with autism. And it was important for them to reduce stress. I want to show you a little segment, get my clicker to work, from Super Nanny. Because Super Nanny was called into a home with a child who has autism. And actually, she's a wise woman, and she recognized when she was up against something that was a little too challenging for her. And so she invited Lynn Kegel, Robert Kegel's partner in this research, to work with a child and use pivotal response training. So you'll see this is from like one of the very first sessions with this child.
Develop Tristan's speech. So Dr. Kegel introduced the communication technique. Today we started with three steps for working on communication. The first one was finding something he likes, and something that he likes enough that he's going to try to talk for. Tristan loves the swing, so we use that to provide opportunities for him to say swing. Just push him a little bit and get him involved in the activity, and then stop the swing and say, swing?
Okay.
Yeah.
This is the highlight of his day.
Yeah. So let's stop him, and now try to prompt it.
Swing.
The second step is prompting him to talk, and the third is rewarding him for any attempt or any good word.
Swing? Swing? Tristan, swing?
You have to say the word 10 times before he'll even try to say it or attempt to say it, and he'll be upset, which that's going to be really hard for me as a mother because he's my baby.
I want him not to swing too much without saying it so he doesn't say it. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, gosh.
Come here. Let's go in the house.
Let's go. We have to keep giving him opportunities and keep working at him.
Tristan. Cookie. Cookie.
Look.
I'd be like, you're betraying me, you know?
The important thing is that if he does get upset and is trying other things like crying, that they don't give it to him.
I know, this is the hardest part.
The first few words are the hardest. Look at me. You want to do everything to keep your kids happy, but, you know, the only thing is he won't learn to talk that way. He's got to, we've got to teach him the words to say and that this doesn't work anymore. Because we don't want him to be 21 doing that.
No, definitely not.
Deirdre did a great job. I felt like it was very difficult for her to see him cry. But he has to learn that if he cries, it's not a good way to eat.
Tickle.
It's important that he learns that he's got to try to say the word in order to get the item that he wants.
Tickle.
That's the first word I think that he said on command. So it was such an exciting moment.
Tickle. Tickle. I think he's laughing and saying it because he knows what he's going to get. I started crying. I was like, oh my goodness. My son has it in him. And if he has it in him, I am all for bringing out his potential.
Got a little frustrated at the beginning, but this, you know, now he's going to get it slowly, you know, fully but surely.
Deirdre put in a lot of effort, and if she...
Okay. And they've identified some other pivotal responses that they feel are very important. For example, one thing they learned is that oftentimes a child with autism's attention is focused not really on the relevant dimension. So, for example, if I had an array of stuffed animals out here, I had a teddy bear and a bunny and a stuffed chicken, since we're getting ready for Easter, and we say, give me the teddy bear, and child reliably gives you the teddy bear, looks great, until you cut off the little tiny tag that was sewn in the seam of that teddy bear. And he can't tell which one's the teddy bear because he was never really looking at the shape of the animal. He was focused on the little tiny tag that was in the seam. And so one of the things that the Kegels recommend is that we use multiple cues. So I have a blue bear and a pink bear and a white bunny and a yellow chick. And then I ask him to give me the pink bear. And he's got to think not about the little labels. He's got to think pink and he's got to think bear because there's a blue bear sitting over here. So he has to pay attention to multiple cues at once. That was one of the pivotal behaviors that they found were important. So they set up trials where you have to have multiple cues. Those would be working with the antecedent on that condition. He also found that it was important to reinforce children for initiating interactions, or self-initiating anything. When we did research with normal children, preschoolers, infants and toddlers who were learning to talk, what we learned was that very young children make hundreds of initiations a day with adults. And the vast majority of those interactions are the child initiates, not the adult. It's the child who goes up and shows you the toy, or the child that grabs your hand, or the child that says, look at me. And children with autism don't do that. So they found a pivotal response is to reinforce children for doing those initiations. So that was a really important one. And once they could learn to ask questions, go up to people and ask questions and so on, that opened a whole array of behaviors. You didn't have to teach every individual skill. Self-management was another one that sometimes they weren't aware of their own behaviors. So can they count their own behaviors and keep track of what they're doing. Can they reinforce themselves when they've done a good job and so on, especially as children get older. Now we're going to move to another project. Again, this one's from our neighborhood, University of Washington. And I went to Eileen Schwartz next because Eileen Schwartz, who's the director of the Experimental Education Unit at the University of Washington, was an undergraduate student of Robert Cagle. That was the other thing we loved, going to visit these centers. It was like, okay, so we have Sid Bijou, whose student was Ivar Lovas, whose student was Robert Cagle, whose student was Eileen Schwartz. And each one of them has done their own variation on ABA therapy. Each one has extended the field a little bit. She developed Project Data Model because she felt that long hours of therapy with children who have autism was not developmentally appropriate for preschool children. And she believed that public schools who provide special education for children would never get to the point where they would provide 40 hours of one-on-one therapy a week. That what they did was they work in group settings in preschools. So she set up Project Data, which stands for Developmentally Appropriate Treatment for Autism, to bring together the best of what we know about early childhood education and about special education. So children who are enrolled in Project Data attend a group preschool with normal preschool children, but they stay for an extended period of time where they do get some highly structured one-on-one therapy on whatever individualized specific behaviors they need to do, especially behaviors that will help them when they're back in the group preschool with their typical peers. They also provide extra time. You'll see some evening times there with a parent group, with visits to the home, with helping parents to set up other therapies that they have going on, because children with autism may also be getting occupational therapy and physical therapy and other speech and language therapy and so on. And they have also tried out these same components, the same sort of model, with very young infants and toddlers from their earliest diagnosis up to age 3, and then they go into the preschool after age 3. They were funded nationally, so they've done a lot of training with other preschools around the country, and I know we have preschools in our own area that have been trained with the Project Data model. They felt that what children needed were some specific core skills for working with other children in that group preschool setting. So they focus on attending, paying attention, watching other people, being observant, and imitating their peers, doing things in the same way. That's a separate skill that a child has to learn. Of course, communication and playing. Often children with autism don't know how to use toys, don't interact with toys in the same way that normal children do. Social interaction and any other positive behaviors that you might need in the classroom. Those would be worked on not just in the one-on-one therapy, but also in the preschool group. One aspect of their therapy, too, is they use a lot of visual supports. Something that we've been, this is all on the antecedent end of that three-term contingency. We know that children with autism actually have some very good visual strengths. And often what they don't understand what you're saying orally or verbally, they do understand in a photograph or a picture. So if we provide more visual supports, we can help children by reducing some of their anxiety about transitions, helping the world be a little more predictable for them. And I'm just going to quickly cover these, because I think we've talked about this a little bit in earlier procedures. The picture exchange communication system was developed by Lori Frost, who's a speech and language therapist, and by her husband, Andy Bondi, who is a behaviorist. And they thought the child needs to communicate. If he doesn't have words to communicate, we need another way. And what we do is to give the child pictures. So he just learns that it's a give and a take for communication. He's given a set of pictures he can exchange for possible reinforcers. So initially, we find out, what does the child prefer? What would the child enjoy playing with or being with? Then let's make a picture of that, sometimes a photograph. But the thing that's kind of interesting about this system is that two trainers initially work with the child. One sits in front of the child. I'm going to be the communication person. You give me the picture, I'm going to give you this fun thing that you really would like to have. But another person is behind the child, out of sight, but prompting the child, helping him move that hand forward, pick up that picture, and hand it to the therapist. And it's a little bit easier when someone is out of sight to reduce all that assistance so they can become more and more independent. And so once a child has learned to pick up the picture, give it to someone, and get his treat in return, the communication partner moves a little further away. The child has to stand up, walk over, make more of an effort to communicate, get that picture to them. And then the child is not just choosing one picture that happens to be on the table, has to pick from two pictures or three pictures on the table, has to choose the right one, what he wants to have, and carry it over to the communication person. And then the student starts to learn to put it together in a sentence. So he'll have pictures that say, I want. And he has to fill in the right blank with the right picture, take the whole strip over to the teacher, communication partner. Now, I want to show you, this is a little bit of a dated video, but it shows very well how someone prompts from behind. And I'm going to emphasize that because we're going to go visit another model where that strategy is used to teach some other things for independence. So it turns out to be a strategy that works pretty well in a variety of ways.
Phase one of the training is the physically assisted exchange. No time will be spent on teaching the child prerequisite skills such as sitting or looking at the trainer. The initial setting takes advantage of the child's strong interest in the reinforcing item.
Very nice.
Two trainers are used to ensure that the child will learn to communicate spontaneously. One trainer is the child's communicative partner. The communicative partner sits across from the child and draws the child's attention to the initial training item. The other trainer is the physical prompter, or the trainer who will physically assist the child to engage in communicative behavior. The communicative partner draws the child's attention to the reinforcer primarily by showing the reinforcer to the child. The communicative partner does nothing else to aid the child. She does not ask questions or talk to the child. Once the child sees a favorite item, the natural response is to reach for it. This is the child's first initiation. It is at this point that the physical prompter guides this reach to what will become the communicative behavior. Picking up the picture of the favorite item, reaching toward the communicative partner, and releasing the picture into the communicative partner's hand.
So you get the point, but as I say, I'm going to show you a couple other strategies where they use the same, that prompting from behind as a useful way. Another thing that's done at the University of Washington are social stories. And social stories are a simple story written from the child's perspective. And it helps a child prepare for changes in routine, transitions that might be occurring, new situations the child might be going into. There's specific parts of a social story. You tell the who, what, and when of what's involved, like the children sit in a circle and do calendar time. And you tell what other people are thinking or feeling. My teacher's happy to see everyone sitting in their squares, on their squares. He suggests an appropriate behavior. I can try to sit on this square. He suggests how to remember to use the story. When I go to circle, I will ask my teacher where my square is. And you tell others how others will help. My teacher will tell me where my square is. And the child might read the story and then go to circle time and act out the parts that he's seen. As I say, they're usually illustrated, so a social story, again, will have a picture to go along with each one of the steps. So we're emphasizing the visual strengths for that child. And visual schedules are used a lot at the University of Washington, where you use objects, maybe, or photos, icons, words to show a sequence of activity. First this, then that. And it helps a child who's finishing one activity can look at the schedule to see what comes up next, may understand it visually, when the child otherwise would be very disruptive because you're interrupting what he's doing right now, making him go to something else. So it increases the overall probability. Okay, we're going to move out of the University of Washington. And actually, those early researchers that were there originally with Sid Bijou and Ivar Lovas and all those folks at the University of Washington. They left the University of Washington as well, and they went out to the University of Kansas, and where they started training behaviorists. And if you remember when Dennis introduced me, so I was a graduate of the University of Kansas, as is my husband, and we were very proud to go there. At that time, it was really the mecca for the best training in applied behavior analysis in the United States, because all of these great graduate students grew up to be pioneers in the field and fabulous teachers. Well, two other KU alumni, Patricia Krantz and Lynn McClanahan, they took their newly minted PhDs and they moved from the University of Kansas to the East Coast, where they established the Princeton Child Development Institute. They are not related to Princeton University. It happened to be in Princeton, New Jersey, but they're not affiliated with the university. They developed a database treatment program, first for preschoolers and for school-aged children. And then they learned that their children were growing older and were sort of too old for school, but still didn't have all of the skills they needed to live independently. So they established the Family Focus a group home program, a residential program for adults who still have autism and still require some assistance in learning how to be independent. They based it on a behavioral program that had been started at the University of Kansas, which was called the Teaching Family Model. And the idea was these weren't just group homes where you lived. They were homes where you learned, and you learned all day long. So you learned how to do things independently for yourself. And the adults who were in the home were your teachers, and they set up situations for you so you could practice that independence. Now, they serve everyone from children under 24 months of age through adults, some in preschool, some in homes, some in school classrooms, but some in these residential centers. They decided that they didn't like Lovas' discrete trial training because they thought what was happening was kids were learning to wait. They kind of go through the teaching steps, and then while you played with your reinforcer or whatever, we just sat back. The child didn't have to do anything until the teacher gave another cue to get started. So you'd like work, 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 stop. Wait. Somebody would get you started again. Work, 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 stop. Wait. Until someone got you started. You weren't initiating. You weren't independent, which is a huge problem for people with autism. So they wanted to teach that independence rather than having them be good waiters. So they took the activity schedule and extended it much further, using the same kind of prompting method that we showed you with PECS, with somebody who's prompting from behind to help. They might start a young child just with one picture in an activity schedule, probably something they really love to do. And the prompter would take them over to a notebook, help them open the page of the first notebook, find the picture, and then get that item that he could play with, have fun with, have a good time. And then gradually steps are added into it so that eventually the child might get off the bus, come into the home after school, walk over to the activity schedule, open the first page, which might say, put the dishes in the dishwasher. Go over, put the dishes in the dishwasher, go back to the activity schedule, turn the page, find the second activity, which might say, go clean up your room. Go to his room, put things away, come back to the activity schedule, open up the next page, the picture that might say, do your homework and show pictures of the photos. Get out his homework items from boxes that have been labeled and so on. So I want to show you just a clip of a young child working fairly independently with an activity schedule. And you'll kind of be amazed this child looks like he's all by himself. He kind of is, but he's learning to do things on his own.
People with autism have a strength in visual perception, and they also have a deficit in understanding, listening to, comprehending verbal communication. Organizing and attending to materials and understanding what is important is really difficult for people with autism. Another way to say that would be that once they're attending to one thing, they have a really intense focus on that one thing, and they have trouble shifting their attention to other things in the environment. So external organizations are really important to help them know what should they be focusing on and to maintain that attention and not get overwhelmed by other things in the environment, and then it helps them shift their attention from one thing to another. A visual schedule equates to what most adults use in their daily life in terms of like a day planner. We have a list of everything we're going to do throughout the day. Well, a visual schedule can be a written schedule for a person with autism. Oftentimes for children who are younger or an adult with autism who's a non-reader, a visual schedule is each of the activities in their day represented in one picture. So for example, when the person wakes up, it might say breakfast. Then the next thing on their schedule is go to school, and then the next thing on their schedule, whatever it is that they're going to do at school. So it's a visual representation of what's going to happen throughout the day. I have seen kids who are totally dependent on adult prompts become independent, moving throughout their day, learning to move from one area in a school building to another area in a school building without adult support or without support of someone else. The most important thing about visual schedules is that they have to meet the individual needs of the child. And once the child has a system that he understands or she understands, that system can be used to teach any number, anything else that child needs to learn, and it can be used in a lot of different environments. So people.
And as a child, as a person in the system at Princeton becomes more and more sophisticated, they actually, one of the last things they learn is how to write their own activity schedule. So they go through steps and they prepare their own schedules. And it does become, for those readers, it becomes like a day planner, just like you and I do all the time. So they're working them up from that very simple level to a very sophisticated level of independence. They decided to do the same thing for conversational kinds of exchanges that people need to have. And they call that script fading. For a very young child, what you see in here is a machine, which is sometimes called a language master. There are a variety of them. But you can actually record a word or a sentence on the metallic tape, and the child can learn to put the card in the machine, and it will say it out loud. And the child can imitate this, if the child can speak, can imitate it, or just play that as part of their part of a conversation. So for a toddler, what might be on that card might just be up. Like any other normal child, he asks to be lifted up. But he can put it in his language master, and it says up, and he can be lifted. But we try to prompt the child to say up, and then gradually fade that card away until he's just saying up on his own without the help. Now, the scripts become a lot more sophisticated again, so they could be completely written out scripts. Perhaps a preschooler would be saying, have a conversation about fire trucks. I like fire trucks. And the communication partner will respond to that, and then he checks his script and he says the next thing, I like my fire trucks to be red. And they go on with the conversation, say something more. Again, set up a little bit like the text prompting. But the words would be dropped off the script, so eventually the child's not seeing I like fire trucks, he's seeing I like fire, I like, I, and he does it on his own, I like fire trucks. For a young adult, it might be something more like I'm learning to shave. So he can, and so he has responses to a conversation. He memorizes scripts, but then he gets more and more scripts in his repertoire until he can start to handle what seem to be a little more like independent, normal conversations. Pretty much done the same way that the PECS was done. Well, these were just a few examples of some of the things that were done at the centers that we visited. And I'd like to just hit highlights and a few others that are described in the book. So I don't want to keep you too much late. I know American Idol is already on, and I plan to watch it later tonight. One of the centers that we visited was the Strategic Teaching and Reinforcement Systems, the STARS program, which was founded by Jim Partington, who happened to be actually a colleague of mine as an undergraduate, and went on to develop this program. They took a single book that Skinner wrote, which was called Verbal Behavior, which was all about how people learn language, And they've taken that and made it into a teaching program to concentrate on the development of language skills from a behavioral approach. But it's a very different approach than is used in many other behavioral programs. They work, they had their own school for a while, and then they started establishing classroom sites in local schools where they consult. But they also work a lot with parents at a distance. Parents will come to their center, be trained in this verbal behavior training system, and then go back to their homes, do the therapy with their children, and send videotapes back for analysis and feedback. So they may be at a great distance and still getting assistance from Jim Partington. They've also done the same with people around the world. So we have some, they have some centers in very exotic locations. The New England Center for Children was started by Vince Strully. Whoops, sorry, let me change photos here. He actually, it was the last loan he got from his father, I think. I've forgotten. I think it was like $625 his father loaned him. So that's it. You know, that's your entire inheritance. You don't get anything more. And he set up his own school at the New England Center for Children. They use behavioral strategies for a whole variety of things with children from preschool all the way through pre-vocational training. But one of the coolest things that they do is called the ACE. And the ACE is the Autism Curriculum Encyclopedia. It's a completely computerized teaching system that you can actually purchase now separately and use. And the program comes with a whole database that will tell you how to assess for a particular skill. We'll give you lesson plans for teaching that skill, the teaching materials, data sheets to record how a child is doing, and protocols that will help you with graphing and making progress reports. And at the time we visited them, they had more than 900 discrete skills that they could be taught through that program, and they keep adding to it all of the time. So a complete curriculum for a child who has those special needs. The May Institute, and this is Dennis Rousseau, who was actually another LOVAS student from UCLA who went east. He was the project manager for the May Institute. They brought a business model to the behavioral training. They have lovely, effective behavioral programs for all kinds of people with developmental delays. But they were responding to this need with these huge numbers of people who need help. And their response was, you know, yeah, you can do this one-on-one with one child at a time, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who need this kind of training. And so they have provided a whole system of care. It's been franchised so that they have centers around throughout the East Coast, North and South, and are just now opening up on the west part of the country. In California, they set up their first center, so we're starting to see them move across the country. One of the cool things they're doing is working on military bases. Military families sometimes who have children with disabilities come here to Spokane because it's one of the best cities for special education services. But they're trying to provide May Institute behavioral services at different military bases. The last center that we visited was the Judge Rotenberg Center. This was actually by far the most controversial, and we have gotten some hate mail for including this center in our book, which is very difficult to take. But the reason it's very controversial is that it is known for its near non-exclusion. They take any individual with autism, no matter how violent or aggressive that person may be. And some of their individuals come right out of prison cells. Some of their children have been in other effective programs that we visited, but failed to progress in those programs. So these are oftentimes their averages. They've failed out of maybe three other effective behavioral programs before they come to the Judge Rotenberg Center. The Judge Rotenberg Center will work with them for months using reinforcement-only kinds of strategies to try to contain violent and aggressive behavior that may be very dangerous to them or to others before they will implement aversives. But they do use punishers. And because there is such there's such strong feeling against the use of punishers, many other behaviorists will not recommend this particular center. But for parents who are desperate and are in need with children who really need something very, very intensive, this may be the center of choice. They have a school, they have residential center, they have work training, and so on. They will, as I say, try for months, And then they implement aversive therapies only with parent permission and only after a review by a court system. A judge has to review this and look at their data and decide that indeed the child cannot make progress or the adult cannot make progress using positive-only methods before aversives are used. When you visit that center, you think that you're at a prep school. The gentlemen are dressed sometimes in nice slacks, maybe a tie, suit coats. The girls are wearing nice slacks, skirts. You can barely identify that these are people with autism. They have computerized systems and so on. They also have 24-hour, 7 days a week, every inch of that place is under video surveillance. And they have live observers who watch all of the time. So it's a very, very intensive and very different kind of system. But we included it because we wanted people to know what is available across the whole range. One thing that's in common with all of these behavioral sites is that they train their staff or they hire their supervising staff only those who have board certified behavior analysts. We have a national professional organization that certifies behavior analysts. And most insurance companies, if they're going to pay for ABA treatment, they will want that treatment supervised by a board-certified behavior analyst. This is someone at the master's degree level who has at least 225 classroom hours of very specific graduate-level ABA coursework. They review each of the university's programs before they are approved to offer ABA certification. Gonzaga is in our area. It's the only one in our area that's approved for that, for board certification. They also need to meet hundreds of hours of supervised experience, and they have to pass a difficult examination and then continue training throughout their years. They also will offer board-certified assistant behavior analysts, but they couldn't supervise programs. They could be therapists. So we recommend that if you're a parent and want behavioral treatment, that you look for that treatment to be supervised by somebody who has this board certification. It's a very critical part to making sure that you're really getting appropriate services. So what's today's Oldsmobile look like? Its basic components have probably stayed the same since the 1970s, but it's a lot more refined, it's a lot more sophisticated, it's more appropriate for today's context, and it has a lot of options that we like. Underneath, it still has to be the same workhorse it's always been, because it has to be reliable for us. But like the Oldsmobile, ABA has changed enormously since its beginnings. It's a lot more refined, a lot more sophisticated. We have a lot more documentation, and we have a much greater range of options and different contexts that people can use for the treatment of their own child. The one thing that is in common, though, with these behavioral principles, though they were established more than 50 years ago, is that they still require intense human intervention. They require commitment not just for hours, but for years. And great improvement and recovery are possible, but this is not a magic bullet. It's a lot of hard work. I'm going to end this presentation, and I'm going to let Temple Grandin's words take us out of here, as portrayed by Claire Danes. But I think she sums up some of the challenges and also some of the promise of this field.
Autism is not a psychological problem.
I am not familiar with
the remedy. Calm down, sweetie.
It would be better if you could get her to sit calmly. Or try to control her.
What are you talking about?
But we were told self-stimming is good. It eventually calms them.
Self-stimming? Yes, self-comfort.
Self-stimulation. Rocking. Spinning, rolling on the floor, flapping.
Well, I think spinning is good. And then rolling, too. Self-stimulation does seem to eventually calm the nervous system. It can be a way to compensate for not being held. And being held by another person is scary, but rolling or being held by surfaces produces the calming effect that ordinary children get from a hug.
How old's your child?
Well, I don't have children.
Oh.
No, I'm autistic. And I need the sensation of being hugged. And I've developed a machine that I get into and hugs me, and I'm different afterwards. I'm more social. Well, I didn't speak until I was 4. Now I have a BA and a master's, and I'm studying for my doctorate. Most autistic people are very sensitive to sounds and colors. Overstimulation hurts. You know, people talking too much at once, you know, can cause us to panic.
How did you get cured?
Well, I'm not cured. I'll always be autistic. My mother refused to believe that I wouldn't speak. And when I learned to speak, she made me go to school. And in school and at home, manners and rules were really important. They were pounded into me. I was lucky. All these things worked for me. Everyone worked hard to make sure that I was engaged. And they knew I was different, but not less. And I had a gift. I could see the world in a new way. I could see details that other people were blind to. My mother pushed me to become self-sufficient. I worked summers at my aunt's ranch, went to boarding school and college. Those things were uncomfortable for me at first, but they helped me to open doors to new worlds.
Excuse me, please, but we want to hear everything.
Yes.
Just a little bit before what I wanted to show, which is her symbolism of a door opening. And that's how she would picture the next opportunity in her life. And I think that's what we're in the business of doing. Behaviors are trying to open doors for people. I think that it's important that you understand that one behavioral program is not necessarily exactly like the others. That you do need to have database programs, you do need to have trained people. But there's a lot of different contexts, a lot of opportunities out there. A lot of doors to open. I want to thank you very much for coming tonight. I know that we have students who need to get to their studies. We have families who need to get to their children. Randy and I will be out in the lobby and happy to answer any questions that you might have. I want to give you the opportunity to leave. And just thank you. It's been a wonderful 4 years. I'm sorry I won't be back again next year doing the same thing, but it's in good hands. So good night, everyone.